Let's go now to chapter 28, it looks like, which is about the opposite process that we just have been talking about. Now we're going to talk about fatty acid synthesis, which occurs, it can occur chiefly in the liver and in adipose tissue, as you might expect. And also, as you might expect, it's not simply the reverse of fatty acid degradation. You don't just run the process in reverse using the same enzymes, like we've seen for other examples of opposite pathways. But acetyl coenzyme A is one necessary ingredient in building a fatty acid. In this first slide, we can see that getting acetyl coenzyme A out of the mitochondrion into the cytoplasm, which is where fatty acid synthesis takes place, presents a problem because of what we've already talked about. Acetyl coenzyme A doesn't make it through the inner mitochondrial membrane, which is why we needed that shuttle system in the previous chapter to get it into the mitochondrion. Here we're doing the reverse. We need to get acetyl coenzyme A out into the cytoplasm. Well, it's not going to be the same acetyl coenzyme A. Acetyl coenzyme A is not actually traveling through the membrane, right? Instead, coenzyme A is dropping off its cargo to something else, which once it gets outside is going to be picked up by another coenzyme A that's already outside the mitochondrion. Okay? So this involves some enzymes you should be familiar with already from the citric acid cycle, which is occurring inside the mitochondrion. Notice that oxaloacetate is combining with acetyl coenzyme A to form citrate. That is part of the citric acid cycle, right? The first step. So what's that enzyme? You're not allowed to forget that stuff, even though we've been tested on it. Citrate synthase, exactly. It synthesizes citrate. So you're taking a 4-carbon oxaloacetate, joining it with the 2 carbons of the acetyl to form a 6-carbon citrate. Citrate then gets transported through both membranes with the help of membrane-bound transport proteins, shown in blue and orange. And so now you have citrate out in the cytoplasm. Well, now the reverse needs to take place. So citrate really, in this use, is carrying 2 carbons that it picked up from acetyl coenzyme A inside the mitochondria, and it's going to drop those 2 carbons off to an empty coenzyme A in the cytoplasm so that you have acetyl coenzyme A again, but now outside the mitochondria. So this step, the dismantling of citrate into oxaloacetate and acetyl coenzyme A, actually requires an ATP to do that, which isn't shown here, but that's true. ATP is required to do this, and it is the breaking of a bigger thing into smaller things using something other than water to do the job. So it's not hydrolysis. What do we call enzymes that split things apart without using water? In other words, by means other than hydrolysis? Lyases, exactly. So this enzyme that's not shown here, but is responsible for transforming citrate into oxaloacetate with the help of ATP, is called ATP citrate lyase. All right, well, that liberates an acetyl coenzyme A, which is the goal of this in terms of raw materials. Because each acetyl coenzyme A that's used in this process is carrying 2 carbons that will be incorporated into a longer carbon skeleton of the fatty acid we're trying to build. That oxaloacetate then gets transformed into malate, which I hope you recognize is the reverse of what happens in the citric acid cycle. Right? What's the final step in the citric acid cycle? Conversion of malate into oxaloacetate so you can start the cycle again. This is the reverse of that. So it uses a cytoplasmic version of the same enzyme. What is that enzyme? Malate dehydrogenase, exactly, which is named for how it works in the direction of the citric acid cycle, from malate to oxaloacetate. But it's still called malate dehydrogenase, even though in this case it's working to hydrogenate oxaloacetate rather than to dehydrogenate malate. All right, that forms malate, but it requires NADH to do that, to add those hydrogens. Then malate gets converted into pyruvate. Well, oxaloacetate and malate are both four-carbon compounds, so there's no change in carbons there. How many carbons in a pyruvate? Three. Right, so you're going from a four-carbon to a three-carbon when we go from malate to pyruvate. And therefore, also not shown on this slide is a decarboxylation. Carbon dioxide comes off in this process. And malate gets converted into pyruvate with the help of an enzyme called malic acid, M-A-L-I-C. Malic acid is NADP plus dependent. So it uses NADP as a coenzyme, not NAD. So it kind of, the way this is drawn, kind of implies that NADH gets phosphorylated into NADPH. That's not what's happening. NADH that's coming in as blue gets turned into NAD plus. NAD plus, right, as normal. And then an NADP plus comes in and gets reduced into NADPH in this process. So they just don't show all the details here. All right, that gets you pyruvate that's out in the cytoplasm. That then goes into the mitochondrion and gets converted into oxaloacetate to complete this cycle. Oxaloacetate is four carbons, right? Pyruvate is three, so we need to add another carbon to replace the one we just stripped off right here. And so, can you guess the name of this enzyme that does that job? It's not just a carbon that gets added to the pyruvate. It's a carbon and two oxygens. Yes, it's pyruvate carboxylase. That completes the cycle. So the operation of this cycle effectively transports acetyl coenzyme A out of the mitochondria into the cytoplasm, even though it involves two different coenzyme A's. Now notice on the right side that acetyl coenzyme A and NADPH are both shaded in pink. And that's because they are both requirements for fatty acid synthesis. They're two of the three requirements that fatty acid synthesis has. Acetyl coenzyme A is the source of the carbons for the growing chain. NADPH is a source of reductive power, right? Because fatty acid synthesis is reductive biosynthesis. And that's why we're using NADPH and not NADH, right? NADH is for energy yielding situations. NADPH is for energy requiring situations. The third requirement, by the way, is ATP. But actually in this process, even though it's not shown, ATP is used. It's used up here at ATP synthase lyase. So we're not producing ATP there. We're actually using some. All right, well, let's go to slide two now. We can see this whole cycle that we just discussed, even though not all the details are shown here. We can see the pyruvate going in, the citrate coming out. Okay? The citrate that comes out, like I said, gets split into acetyl coenzyme A and oxaloacetate. Well, the acetyl coenzyme A is already one of our three required things. It's the carbon source. So that's why we have an arrow pointing up to fatty acid. We also need NADPH, like I said. Some of that NADPH comes from this cycle we just talked about. All right? So the malate, by being converted into pyruvate, will reduce NADP plus and NADPH. That supplies some of the reductive power that we need, but not all of it. It's not enough. So we need another source of NADPH. And along comes the pentose phosphate pathway that we've already discussed to the rescue. Right? Remember, that can be used as a source for reductive power in the form of NADPH. So that makes up the rest of the NADPH that's required to make the fatty acid. That leaves only the third requirement, which is ATP. And where does that come from? Glycolysis and oxidative phosphorylation both produce ATP, right? Or I should say glycolysis and cellular respiration, because the citric acid cycle itself produces ATP. Right, so all three components are met, even though it requires different pathways to do that. You have all three things that you need to assemble a fatty acid. All right, let's go to three then, and look at what happens to the acetyl coenzyme A. I said that is the raw material, but acetyl coenzyme A actually needs to be activated in order for it to be able to operate in a synthetic pathway to build things up. The way we activate acetyl coenzyme A is to add another carbon in the form of a carboxyl group to this. And so we're going from two carbons in the acetyl being carried by coenzyme A to three carbons in the form of malonyl being carried by that same coenzyme A. This involves a carboxylation of the two carbons to get that third carbon. That carbon dioxide comes from its stored form, in its dissolved form, bicarbonate, which is why that's on the left side. And this is why we need ATP for this process. So what really is happening here is some of the energy that is being spent by spending ATP, used to be stored in ATP, is being invested in the bond of this additional carboxyl. And what we'll see is that it gets stripped away again to release that energy so that we can hook two carbons together in a growing chain. That's why this is an activated acetyl coenzyme A. All right? So you've spent your ATP. That's why on the right side you have ADP and inorganic phosphate. But you now have a three-carbon activated malonyl coenzyme A to work with. Now, coenzyme A, we're on slide four now. Coenzyme A has been doing the job of carrying these acyls all along. But now, when it comes time to actually assembling them into a fatty acid, these acyl groups need to be carried by something that is can't think of the verb. Something that is hooked to, let's just use that, the enzyme complex responsible for synthesizing the fatty acid. And so coenzyme A can't interact with the enzyme, basically, that's responsible, the enzyme complex. Therefore, we need something very similar that carries the acyl just like coenzyme A does, but is actually an acyl carrier protein, which is what ACP stands for, that we'll see in some of these abbreviations. An acyl carrier protein. So we have an acyl carrier protein in blue ribbon form here in comparison to coenzyme A. And notice that they have in common, structurally, a phosphopantothene group And it's that so this is the same phosphopantothene group that you see in the acyl carrier protein. It has a sulfhydryl at its end, and that's what allows it to be a carrier, right? The hydrogen gets popped off of the sulfhydryl so that whatever you're carrying can be hooked to that sulfur, just like coenzyme A works. But this acyl carrier protein is, I still can't think of the word. Well, anyway, it's associated with, maybe that's what I was thinking of. It's associated with the enzyme complex. So it brings the acyls to where they need to be in order to enzymatically be synthesized. All right, well, in 5, we're looking at a table that lists the enzymes and the steps of this process. We know more about how this happens in bacteria, but it's very similar in eukaryotes. It's just that the enzymes are more complexed in a eukaryote than in a bacteria. They're more separate in a bacterium, but they have the same names. And so we can talk about it. Well, almost the same names. Notice that the first step is one we've already talked about. That's the conversion, the activation of acetyl coenzyme A by adding that extra carbon into malonyl carbon coenzyme A. That is acetyl coenzyme A carboxylase, which I think I forgot to mention. I didn't give you that enzyme name yet, did I? That's the committed step of this overall process. So what does that tell you about that enzyme? What is it? Well, it means that that's a good candidate for being a regulated enzyme, exactly. So the major regulation of this whole process is via changes in acetyl coenzyme A carboxylase. All right, the second and the third one, notice, have similar names. They are both transacylases. The enzymes are, that is. And that's because it's really just taking an acyl group from some carrier and putting that same acyl group onto another carrier. This is where the acyl carrier proteins come into play. So the acyl that's being carried by coenzyme A gets shifted to an acyl carrier protein. In step 2, it's acetyl coenzyme A, specifically that's the acyl, and therefore you produce acetyl ACP, acetyl acyl carrier protein, right? And so that one is acetyl transacylase specifically. You also, though, transfer a malonyl from a malonyl coenzyme A that you just made in step 1 to an acyl carrier protein. So that's malonyl transacylase. These are separate enzymes in a bacterium, but in eukaryotes, looks like one enzyme does both jobs. So it's called acetyl malonyl transacylase, doing both steps 2 and 3. All right? That then leaves these 4 steps, which deal with these subunits by joining them together. That's where you actually synthesize the fatty acid. Okay? So beta-ketoacyl synthase, beta-ketoacyl reductase, 3-hydroxyacyl dehydratase, and enol reductase, in that order, operate in a pathway that we will see in a couple slides. Slide 6 just reminds you of what a keto group is so that you understand the names of these things. Remember that it's keto if it's not at the tip of a carbon skeleton. We've already talked about that a lot, though. The pathway here is shown in slide 7 involving those final 4 enzymes. So notice at the top we're starting with an acetyl ACP and a malonyl ACP. So we've already used the first 3 enzymes, right? We used the first enzyme to make malonyl coenzyme A. Then we used enzymes 2 and 3 to transform an acetyl coenzyme A and a malonyl coenzyme A individually into acetyl ACP and malonyl ACP. That's what we have to start with. So the only difference is these things are being carried by the proteins that are associated with the enzyme complex rather than being carried by coenzyme A. But one of them, the acetyl ACP, is a 2-carbon compound. well, two carbons in the part that matters. I'm not counting the carbons that are in the acyl carrier protein. Whereas malonyl is carrying a three carbons, right? If you get these things together, you'd expect to make a five-carbon compound. But notice that there's a decarboxylation step in this first condensation reaction. It's condensation because you're synthesizing. You're bringing two smaller things together into one bigger thing. But you don't keep all five of the carbons. You're losing one of them in the form of carbon dioxide, just being spit off. And therefore, what you make is a four-carbon compound, which is acetoacetyl ACP. Now, the reason that ACP is being spit off to the side in blue is because you had two ACPs, each one carrying its own acyl. You only need one ACP now because you have one acyl that contains all four of the remaining carbons. Right? That ACP is empty now. That blue one. All right, notice that the acetyl ACP has these two ketone groups. So we need to deal with that, and that's why a reduction step is necessary. The reduction step gets its reductive power from NADPH, which is why it's one of the three requirements for fatty acid synthesis. All right. The hydrogens that get stripped from NADPH get stuck on in order to break the blue double bond. That leads to D3 hydroxybutyryl ACP. And then we have a dehydration step. So water is leaving. That actually forms another double bond that you just got rid of, but it's in a different position. By rearranging it this way, though, that sets it up for this final reduction. That intermediate, by the way, is crotonyl ACP. The final reduction, though, which requires another NADPH, is going to saturate the two carbons that just had a double bond formed between them. Right? When you have a double bond between the carbons, they're not saturated because they're not holding as many hydrogens as they can since they're involved in that second bond between the carbons. When you turn that double bond into a single bond, that means each of the two carbons can hold one more hydrogen as an additional bond. And that's why we call things that have only single bonds saturated fatty acids. So we're saturating these carbons in this final reduction step, which is why they now have two H2s. We're turning them both into methylene groups, in other words, which is what we want to make a saturated fatty acid. We want to just string together a bunch of methylenes, if you want to think about it as a goal. And by the way, that's what we do. When we synthesize a fatty acid, what we really do is synthesize palmitate, which is a 16-carbon saturated fatty acid, which is like the master fatty acid, which can then, after you make it, be modified. You know, you could put double bonds into it after that to make it an unsaturated fatty acid, for instance. Keep it as is, because palmitate is also valuable in itself. But if you're using this, depends on what you're going to use the fatty acid for. If you're using it, for instance, as a signal molecule, which several signals involve these fatty acids, then those typically involve double bonds. So it's going to, you still make the palmitate, but then you end up changing its structure. All right, well, before I finish that, we've just gone through one iteration here. So these names are crotonyl and butyryl. Those are specific names that apply only to this particular substance and this particular substance with that exact number of carbons. Notice that butyryl It's a name, just like in butane, has four carbons, right? So you've incorporated two pairs of carbons into a now four-carbon fatty acyl that's still being carried by the ACP. Well, you just go through the steps again now to make it longer. So instead of acetyl ACP at the top coming in, you use the butyryl ACP in the second iteration, which already has four, combine that with a malonyl and get rid of one of them as carbon dioxide. Now you're going to end up with, after these next steps, to have six. So you just keep doing that for however long you're going to make the fatty acyl. Like I said, you're going to make it 16, because when you get to 16 carbons, that's when the enzyme that separates the fatty acyl from the acyl carrier protein will operate. So it senses when there are 16 carbons there and then cleaves it off of the acyl carrier protein. All right? And that's a thiolase that does that. Why is it called a thiolase? Because the acyl carrier protein has the sulfur that makes it, that allows it to carry that acyl. Thio means sulfur, right? Well, I don't know how much information you can get from slide 8. This is just a cartoon version of what we know about the structure of what is called the fatty acid synthase complex in eukaryotes. Remember I said a little bit earlier that in eukaryotes, the enzymes responsible for all this are more complexed together than in bacteria. And really there's two versions of each one. Its whole thing is a dimer. All of these are connected to each other, and all of these are connected to each other, and they're duplicates of each other. But it doesn't operate unless it actually is a dimer. They help each other out. But I'm not going to get too bogged down in the details of this either, except to notice that there is what is called a selecting and condensing compartment, which is a domain separate from the modification compartment. And this just is a division of labor within this overall complex. All right? Selecting and condensing compartment is going to take part in that condensation reaction, send it to the other compartment, which then sends it through the other three major steps that will create the acyl that's now two carbons longer. And then it just repeats. But like I said, once you get to the point where you have palmitate, 16 carbons long, then the thiolase is able to do its job of cleaving it off, and you have no longer a fatty acyl being carried by an acyl carrier protein. You have a fatty acid in its own right. Now that fatty acid can be used for various things that fatty acids are used for. For instance, it could be incorporated into a phospholipid as a membrane component. It could be modified into a signal molecule. It could be a component of a triacyl glycerol and stored as the form in a form of fat, right? So all the things that fatty acids do, this would be good for. Now, we're not necessarily constantly doing this because we get plenty of fatty acids in the diet. But the liver and adipose tissue have the ability to do this, especially in case fatty acids happen to be in short supply, which is possible. Slide 9. Well, I was talking about signal molecules, and we're looking at the names of a bunch of signal molecules here, and I don't really want you to memorize these names, but you've probably heard of some of these before. Thromboxanes, prostacyclins, prostaglandins, they operate as paracrine signals. How is a paracrine signal different from an endocrine signal? It's another name for an endocrine signal. Right. A hormone is an endocrine signal. It gets delivered into the bloodstream and then gets broadcast throughout the body. So any part of the body that happens to have the right receptor for that signal, that hormone, will have some sort of an effect. Paracrines are classified that way functionally. Nothing different about their structure necessarily, but they're functionally classified as paracrine signals because the cells that release them just release them into the interstitial fluid, so they end up only getting exposed to very nearby cells. They operate under over short distances rather than being broadcast. Yeah.
What was the name?
Interstitial, which just means the extracellular fluid. Interstitial fluid is the fluid between cells, which is really outside of cells. All right, so there's all kinds of paracrine signals, but these ones listed here on the bottom are examples of paracrine signals, and they're important for inflammation and other reasons. But notice that they all come from leukotrienes as well, all come from arachidonate, which is the master lipid from which these all are made, kind of like cholesterol is the master lipid for all the steroid hormones. And arachidonate is a 20-carbon compound. And therefore, all of these other 20-carbon compounds that come from the master 20-carbon compound are called eicosanoids. Oh, nice. It's marked black, but it's actually a white marker. Eicosanoids you might have heard about before, though, right? Have you ever read that word, eicosanoids? What does eicosa mean? You gaming nerds should know what an icosahedron is. That's the 20-sided die, right? Yeah, icosa means 20. So these eicosanoids are called that because they have 20 carbons. So that's just one of the uses of fatty acids that are assembled. But that's really all I want to say about the slide. I don't want to get into how these signals work because that's not really the point of this chapter. All right, in 10, we're looking at the master enzyme in terms of control. Remember, we said that that is the enzyme that controls that committed step. It's the carboxylase enzyme. What is its full name? Acetyl coenzyme A carboxylase, correct. And just like we've seen in a lot of other examples, part of the control of this enzyme is via covalent modification, specifically phosphorylation. And remember, you can't tell whether phosphorylation turns something on or turns something off unless you know the specific case. In the case of acetyl coenzyme A carboxylase, phosphorylation will inactivate the enzyme. Whereas dephosphorylation will activate it, of course. That's one way in which it's controlled, and that's the major way. That has most of the effect. Now, on top, notice that in blue, you have listed the name of another enzyme, an enzyme that's able to control this enzyme. AMP-activated protein kinase. The name gives away what activates it, right? When levels of AMP are high, AMP-activated protein kinase will become activated. It is a kinase whose job it is to phosphorylate acetyl coenzyme A carboxylase. But because phosphorylation of acetyl coenzyme A carboxylase inactivates it, That means activation of AMP activated protein kinase will turn off fatty acid synthesis. All right, everyone clear on that? Now, why does it make sense for the enzyme that controls carboxylase, in other words, the AMP activated protein kinase, why does it make sense for it to be activated by AMP? Right, AMP in abundance is a signal that you have low energy charge. When you have low energy charge, you have no business taking valuable energy in the form of the acetyl coenzyme A's and assembling them into a storage compound, a fatty acid, right? Because you need to burn the fuel, not take it out of the system and store it. So under conditions of low energy charge, acetyl coenzyme A carboxylase is inactivated so that you do not end up synthesizing fatty acids. Another enzyme does just the reverse. Not surprisingly, its name is a phosphatase because phosphatase's job is to dephosphorylate things. Well, it's specifically protein phosphatase 2A. It's not the only thing called protein phosphatase. There's many different kinds, but this is protein phosphatase 2, specifically 2A. All right? It just will take inactive acetyl coenzyme A carboxylase and activate it. What do you suppose is a signal that activates protein phosphatase 2A and therefore activates fatty acid synthesis? Well, high energy charge will stop the deactivation, but that doesn't phosphorylate the enzyme. It just will stop the further deactivation of any that's already activated. What we need to do is turn on the deactivated version. And under what situations would it be okay to do that? To build a fatty acid? Well, you're correct in saying that it's a situation when energy is not in short supply. But think about further back into the process, not ATP, but just a fed state. If you are fed, you're bringing in plenty of energy into the blood, right? In the form of nutrients. How does the body know you've been fed hormonally? Insulin, exactly. So insulin will knock on the door, like we talked about in other cells, initiate a transduction cascade that will activate this protein phosphatase 2A so that it does its job of taking the phosphate off of inactivated carboxylase, turning it into the active form, signaling to the cell it's now okay to divert some coenzyme A, some acetyl coenzyme A, to the job of producing these fatty acids. Well, that is how the covalent modification works as a control of acetyl coenzyme A synthetase, but it's also allosterically regulated, which we see in slide 11. It's allosterically regulated by citrate. We call this allosteric regulation, of course, because citrate is binding somewhere on the enzyme, not covalently, just temporarily. But that's causing a shape change, a conformation change, that allows it to change its effectiveness. What we see in this slide is that citrate can partially undo the inactivation that phosphorylation does. So a phosphorylated acetyl coenzyme A carboxylase that does not have citrate also on it is as inactive as it's going to be. If you stick some citrate onto it, though, it's not as inactive. So it's partially activated. And then if you, after the citrate is there, if you also strip the phosphate off with the phosphatase enzyme, then it's fully activated. So it's just 2 degrees of regulation. And under what situations would citrate build up? Out in the cytoplasm. Yeah.
Wait, so it's possible that the phosphate can come up while this citrate is still attached, or once that comes up?
No, it's possible for it. Yes, that's a good question. Citrate can be on either a phosphorylated or a dephosphorylated carboxylase enzyme. It's just two separate ways of adjusting the activity. So there are four possibilities, right? Dephosphorylated with citrate bound, dephosphorylated with citrate not bound, phosphorylated with citrate bound, and phosphorylated with citrate not bound. 4 degrees of activity. But back to my question about the citrate. When would it we see a bunch of citrate building up in the cytoplasm, which would allow for this to happen? When? Well, if you have high levels of ATP, then you're not going to need cellular respiration, right? Which means the citric acid cycle is going to be shut down. Citrate is part of the citric acid cycle. So if it's not being used continuously in a running citric acid cycle, it's instead going to be put out into the cytoplasm, where it's a signal to the cell, you already have enough energy. Let's build some fatty acids. Okay? By the way, what else does citrate do that we talked about a long time ago? Well, it seems like a long time ago. What other enzyme does that interact with? A hint, it ends in A's. It's phosphofructokinase. Remember phosphofructokinase? The master control enzyme of what pathway? Glycolysis. So when citrate builds up, it shuts down phosphofructokinase for the same reason. We already have enough energy. Why keep burning fuel when we don't need more ATP at this point? Shuts down glycolysis and turns on fatty acid synthesis via this mechanism. Well, the final slide just shows you how this works graphically. I've already described the situation. But the green trace here is dephosphorylated state. Pink is phosphorylated, as you see. And in, like your question asked, in either the phosphorylated or the dephosphorylated state, you still have a degree of adjustment in the activity of the acetyl coenzyme A carboxylase enzyme via citrate. And when citrate levels rise, as you go to the right of this, then that's going to make whichever form of the enzyme more active. The phosphorylated version is already fairly inactive, but you can make it less inactive with citrate. If you have the unphosphorylated version, it's already pretty active, but you can make it even more active with citrate. And so that is that example of the reflexive property of mathematics.